time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for November 23rd, 2019. May I be one of the first to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. This week, I have two excellent guests on two very diverse topics. Chuck Marone, Mr. Strong Towns, is with me once again to talk about his newest book, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. In the past, Chuck and I have discussed some of the projects in which he's been involved to help cities change the way they think about planning with an eye towards sustainability, fiscal prudence, and a way to make our lives more enjoyable. Now, Chuck looks at complexity and adaptive systems with an eye towards incremental improvements that begin to expand organically instead of big, bold plans that lead to a sprawling infrastructure that discourages small business and bankrupts our cities. I think we're at a point in our history where we need to hear the truth and take action. Chuck will be with me in a moment. My second guest is someone I learned about in a podcast about 2 years ago in a dazzling conversation with Sam Harris. At the time, Brett Weinstein had been ousted as a valued and popular professor at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. He objected to a change the college made in their decades-old tradition of a day of absence, and what ensued from a letter he wrote turned into utter chaos. If you hadn't heard or read about it, you can find out about what happened online. But I reached out to Brett because I had a philosophical issue on which I'd been pondering since April, when I last talked with Inga Thompson on the show. I believed Brett would have a well-reasoned and deep understanding of the issue. And indeed, he did, and he does. Fraught with deep, visceral, and often beyond contentious upset, the question is whether transgender athletes should compete with cisgender athletes, especially at the elite level. It all came to a head for me when Rachel McKinnon crushed the field at the UCI World Track Championships and then subsequently tried to also crush any dissent that she should be treated the same way in sport as she is in life. But the nagging question that I couldn't shake was, is it fair? I think you'll enjoy both of our conversations this evening, so let's begin with Strong Towns, Chuck Marone. Hi, Chuck. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Last time we spoke, believe it or not, June of 2018, we caught up on some of your on-the-ground projects. But now I want to talk about your new book, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. And it sounds like a really tall order. How's the book doing?
It is so nice to be back and chatting with you. The book is doing fantastic. I'm not someone who has like a lot of reference points for this. You know, like I obviously it's not selling as well as Malcolm Gladwell's book, which I got right away when it came out. But you know, there's a ton of buzz, and the metrics that the publisher have been sending us and the accolades and begging for a second book tell me that, like, yeah, this is going pretty well.
Who is this publisher, Wiley? Who is that?
Wiley and Sons. I'll tell you this, and not to be snooty at all.
Oh, I like snooty. Go be snooty. I don't care.
Well, I'm Minnesotan, so we frown on snooty. For years, I've had agents and book people try to get a hold of me or try to talk me into doing a book. Many different publishers in many different ways, and I've been flattered by that. It's been very nice. Wiley and Sons is one of the top distribution houses, publishing companies in the country. They're for sure one of the top 10. I think they might be one of the top 5. They do a lot of nonfiction, a lot of college textbooks. And if you've heard of the Four Dummies series.
Oh, sure.
They actually own that. And that's probably their biggest thing. But they do they do serious nonfiction work, and they wanted a book about cities and about strong towns. And they told us they had the capacity to get it everywhere. And so far, I mean, they've certainly delivered on their side of the promise, which is to get it in stores and places and distributed it to small bookstores and large companies all over. Yeah. So they've been a great partner, really.
Well, you've actually been touring with the book. Every time I try to get an appointment with you to talk, you're somewhere else. So where are you home right now?
I apologize. Yes,
you don't have to apologize.
Well, no, but we've been wanting to make this work. And I kept having to say, sorry, can't then. The book came out October 1st. I have been on the road every day since, with the exception of maybe four or five. I am back home now in Brainerd, Minnesota, my hometown. There's a little bit of snow on the ground and chill in the air. I go back out next week, though, again. And then I've got pretty much every other week through the end of the year, which I've been in Manhattan. I've been in Iowa City. I've been in Seattle and British Columbia. I've been in Atlanta and some of the Atlanta suburbs. We have been in cities big and small and coastal and inland, conservative and liberal, you know, all white and very, very non-white. So it's been a fun trip. And I think the thing about the book tour that we've done is we've looked for anchor events that can basically give us a budget to get in a market. And then we've looked for add-ons, places that, you know, where we can go, where maybe they don't have the money to bring us in, or they, you know, can't support the organization or the movement, but they really are interested in the message. And how many of those can we then tack on and add and get it in front of, so that we can reach, you know, more and more people.
Before we go on, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chuck Marone. He is Mr. Strong Towns. And I can remember back when we very first spoke, when this Strong Towns movement, I can remember some of the conversations we had about how all the other urban engineers were saying, okay, this guy's just full of it, and we don't, we want to kick him out, and we don't want him to be an engineer anymore. But now things have changed, and it's really nice to see that there's so much interest in what you're doing. So give us an overview of the book and why you wrote this one.
If I had to summarize this book, I would say, and it's hard to summarize, but it's had to come about because I've given this presentation like 40 times now. So I've had to do it quickly sometimes. We talk about cities as complex systems, as places that harmonize many different competing objectives. They don't do any of it perfectly. No city is going to be a utopia. But cities are these places where all these different struggles come to bear, and we, working together as a community, figure out how to make our city work. Cities historically have been different from each other, because there were different things, different cultural things, different climate things. You know, a Minnesota city is going to be very different than a California or a Florida city, because we have got different weather here. We have different people here. We do things differently. After World War II, for a variety of good reasons, reasons that had to do with the Depression and our vision of ourselves and what we could be and how we could solve problems, we started to treat our cities not as complex adaptive systems, but as systems that were merely complicated, as things that were a collection of roads and streets and pipes and bridges and zoning districts and buildings. And we lost the nuance, the feedback that comes from the complex system. We did this to create growth. We create growth very quickly. We nostalgize even today how great our cities grew. But over time, because they lack that complex feedback system, they become very fragile. They become overextended. They've become financially frayed, and socially places that struggle very deeply. And so our approach is to explain this transition, not to point blame, because if we're going to point blame, we really have to point blame back at ourselves. I mean, we as a culture have kind of done this to ourselves, but to understand what we did, to understand why it's no longer working, and then to lay out, you know, we're not going to go back. We're not going to like go back to horse and buggy and outhouses and what have you, and typhoid and all that. We're going to do something different, hopefully something better. And here's a way that we go about kind of stitching these places now back together.
You used the ancient city of Pompeii, which I thought was a great analogy of how things worked, how humans lived and they worked and how they raised their families in the context of a city or a place. So why did that work when we think back, to Roman times, and our cities don't work now? What has changed? What has happened? And do we want to go back to that, or what do we want to do to change it?
It's funny because when I went to Pompeii, right before that, I had worked on an Arby's.
So okay.
This was back in my engineering days, and I got handed this project in Arby's, and we were supposed to design a site plan for Arby's. And so I get to Pompeii, and I'm shown what basically is like their Arby's of the day, their fast food place. And I look at it as an engineer and as a planner, and I think, well, how quaint. You know, this is like a smaller version of something I just did. It took me years to unpack how wrong I was. And I tried to, in the book, go through and just explain a tiny fraction of all the complexity that goes into a place like that. I mean, the fact that what you're looking at in that little house with the three little pots out in front was not only like their fast food of the time, but the house was in the back. It was like an income diversity strategy. You had someone who could work a store. They could also keep an eye on kids while someone else went out to the edge of town and got a job. The buildings themselves like lined up. They created a great sense of place. They framed the forum at the center of town, kind of drew that out and drew out the Roman culture and values into these different interconnected places. The layout of the design provides a certain level of policing, like security for the people who live there. The buildings themselves were like adaptable. You could buy the next building and tear down the brick wall or the rock wall and expand yours. Or if you needed the money, you could split them again and rent out the one. And I started to, over time, transform from rote engineer who just looked at things in a very like, okay, this is a street. It has one use. This is a building. It has maybe a couple of uses, but it's all very simple system. To something that was far more complex and interrelated. And the way we talk about in the book is just spooky. This wisdom, this ancient wisdom that you see in a place like Pompeii, or really in any city that was built prior to the Great Depression, has this underlying spooky wisdom, the kind that can only come about through thousands of years of trial and error evolution. It's the kind of thing where, you know, when we see it in the animal world or we see it in the natural ecosystems, we're astounded by it and amazed. We're like, oh my gosh, the genius that could come up with this. When we recognize that it's this process of evolution, it's almost humbling. But then when we look at our own habitat, our own places that we lived, and somehow we think, you know, humans are beyond this, that we're somehow smarter than what literally the accumulated wisdom of thousands of years of humans trying things out is. And that's just wrong. That's just incorrect.
So how do we get people to see how they're wrong and why cities don't work today and why they worked then? I mean, what is it that you can actually say to a city planner or a mayor or an organization within the city, a transportation officials, that shows how wrong the decisions they're making now are for the future of their cities and why they're bankrupting their cities in the process?
This is a really hard one because at the end of the day, it comes down to humility.
And lack thereof.
And understand, I mean, I'm an engineer, I'm a planner. Neither of those professions are taught humility. I mean, they're both taught, here's the problems that you're going to deal with, and then here's the answers to those problems. And they're very kind of, you know, one-dimensional. Maybe sometimes in the planning profession, you're two-dimensional. But the idea is that cities are just complicated machines. Your job as the professionals to go out and tinker with them. I think the same thing kind of happens with elected officials as well. What person are we going to vote for who stands up and says, you know what, All these problems you're dealing with, they're really complex. And the best, I can't solve them for you. I mean, they're not going to be taken care of ever. You're always going to struggle with this. But I, you know, I can make it a little bit easier for you to have the tools to figure this out yourself. We're going to vote that person out of office. And we're going to vote for the person who says, here's the very simple way to analyze this problem. And here's the very direct way that I'm going to fix it. I think the key insight, and to me, there's two things that go together here. The first one is that humans have always been this way. You know, the whole Icarus syndrome, you know, the idea that we can transcend by our own genius and insight all the things that have come before us. This is just a part of humanity. It's how we're wired. It's quite frankly how we've made progress. And so I think denying that and saying, well, we just need people to be humble, I think is naive. And we're not naive. We're not asked calling on people to just be humble. I think, though, that what has happened is that our vision was not used to be constrained by our reach. In other words, we could dream big, but there was only so much we could do. I mean, we didn't always have huge machines. We didn't have massive bond markets. We couldn't tear down a building and rebuild it if we screwed it up. We can do all those things now today. And so in the past, we were forced to work incrementally because we didn't have an option. Today, what we would like to do and why we focus not so much on fixing the mayors and the engineers and the planners and the technical people, but really this broader cultural conversation is that we want the default for society to be incremental steps of action. Let's focus on taking care of the things that are in front of us. Let's take care of them in an incremental way. Let's obsessively deal with maintenance and the problems that we're struggling with. And let's culturally make it unacceptable for people to come in and say, hey, we're going to make this big overnight transformative thing. I think culturally we grasp that this isn't working, that the way we built our cities is not well tuned to who we are as people. And I think the thing that will save us, the thing that will get us a different direction is not to fix the people who are running it, but to actually fix the broader culture or to give the broader culture like a different narrative so that we can demand something new.
You know what? Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about some of the things we can do and how infrastructure plays a role, some of the remedies you think will be helping to turn around some of this prosperity that cities are not having right now. I mean, I'm in a city in deep decline. We're talking with Chuck Marone. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. So we're back, and if you're just joining me, we're talking with Chuck Marone. He's Mr. Strong Towns. His new book is called A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. It's been a fascinating conversation so far. If you didn't hear the first half of it, you ought to rewind it. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the ideas you have to actually make some of these incremental changes as opposed to these huge changes that people would love to see. Oh, we'd love to have bullet trains. We'd love to have, you know, trolleys in every town, you know, across the country. Tell me how you see some of the things that will help to change this dearth of prosperity. I mean, cities are in financial trouble right now.
Oh yeah, cities are in a train wreck. I mean, it is a financial dumpster fire, and people look at pensions as being like the thing that is the blinking red light on the dashboard. Pensions are the symptom. They're the symptom of this deeper rot that we've created, which is really the lack of productivity. So let's talk. Can we talk about cycling as like an example?
Because what a concept.
Okay.
That would be perfect.
I do feel like the cycling world captures this kind of, you know, this dichotomy perfectly. You have people today who are out cycling, and they will cycle whether the environment is despotic or not. Like, they're just like, I'm a cyclist, I'm going to bike. And even if the street is dangerous, and even if, you know, the conditions aren't good, like, I'm going to go out and do it. And you can kind of frame them on the one end, right?
Right.
On the way other end of the spectrum is someone who, like, I'm going to drive my Hummer. I'm never going to bike. Like, I hate biking. Biking takes energy. Like, I'm never going to do it. I think oftentimes what we do as advocates is we say, all right, let's take a look at that guy in the Hummer. And maybe it's not that guy in the Hummer, but maybe it's someone near him. How do we get that person interested in biking? And what we need to do is we need to have something that is really nice and easy and convenient for them. Let's get some separated recreational trails where they can drive their Hummer to a big parking lot and then have their bike attached to the roof and take it down. And then they can enjoy recreational biking and cycling. And, you know, that would be really great. And we can get that, like, let's try to sell that person on biking. And when we do that, what we wind up with are these huge, big plans, these big dreams. And, you know, we can imagine what, like, the ultimate built out cycling network looks like. And we can go out and start to sell this person in the Hummer on joining our effort to build this big thing. The reality is there's someone much closer to the other end who doesn't bike, but would bike if things were just slightly better, slightly easier. You got the person who will go out and bike even when it's super dangerous. But what about the person who, when it's not really dangerous, it's just, you know, it's maybe a little bit dangerous at times, but we can mitigate that somehow. And what happens is that there's this huge bell of people. There's this huge, massive repository of people on that end where if you just make a tiny bit of improvement, they come out. And the thing is, when they come out, then you can actually justify the next level of tiny improvement and the next level and the next level. Here's the other thing. You start to create these feedback loops where, okay, we start with the people who bike now, rain or shine, good or bad. We look at where they're having a difficult time biking. And we say, okay, how do we make that a little bit better? And when we use that feedback, essentially that humble observation of people's struggles to direct our next step, what we do is we allow them now to show us where the next thing is and the next thing and the next thing. And we create these positive feedback loops where we're not addressing some theoretical guy in a Hummer who maybe we can convince to bike, you know, one day a year, but we're actually creating this kind of groundswell of people who will actually use the stuff that we build, because we're building it directly based on addressing their most pressing need. This is how you make really high returning investments, investments that don't cost much, but yield a really high return. It's also how you make people's lives better. It's also how you create these, in a complex adaptive system, these positive feedback loops that drive really productive innovation. We can do this not only in cycling, but we can do this in all facets of city building and see enormous returns with very, very little money spent.
Give me an example of a place that you've worked with that has done something incremental that has paid off like that.
I started the book tour in Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
And I started there because they're one of the most inspirational cities in the country. And I think have done more of this kind of stuff than anybody. A few years ago, Memphis residents brought me out to this little street called Broad Avenue. Broad Avenue is a former streetcar stop. The streetcar got ripped out. There's a highway run through the middle of the neighborhood. These two blocks of businesses just died. They just completely dried up. These people had gone out and using paint and cones and brooms, swept up the stores, swept up the sidewalks, painted some bike lanes, painted some crosswalks, did what I think today we would just call like a tactical urbanism or a better block project to make this couple blocks a little bit better. I think the real technical professionals would look at it and say, well, that's cheesy, or maybe, well, that's quaint. But here's what happened. They went out and did this. They threw a little block party. They invited people to come out and check it out. All of a sudden, people recognized, wow, this is an underutilized space. This is kind of a diamond in the rough. This is a place that could be something. And businesses started to open up. People started to move in. These weren't like the high-end businesses. They were really like starter entrepreneurs, but people getting a go at it. And all of a sudden, this little block that had was totally empty was now had every shop full. The city has identified millions of dollars. I want to say $12 million of property value appreciation. There's been dozens of properties that were blighted in this immediate vicinity that have now been reclaimed. They've created lots of new businesses, dozens of new jobs. And when I was out there on October 2nd, looking at the same block, I haven't been back for a couple of years. I was out there. All of the temporary stuff was gone on these two blocks, and it was replaced now by permanent concrete sidewalk, permanent separated bike lanes, permanent boulevard with trees growing up in it now and nice lighting just on these two blocks. So it's a very small project still. But it was a project that they felt confident taking because they basically had proof of concept. You look two blocks now of either side of the successful two blocks, and what you have are surrounding it are these little temporary projects to try to basically expand over that success and prosperity to build on what has now worked. So Memphis is incrementally working to bring this block back. And with literally pennies on the dollar, they're creating real wealth, real opportunity, and a much better place for people to live.
Wow. So are you coming inspiring. To Cleveland anytime soon?
I'll tell you what. We put out a thing saying, we got this book. Anybody like us to come talk? And we thought we'd get 2-3 dozen.
Oh, yeah, right.
We wound over with over 300 requests.
Wow.
And many, many, many were in Ohio. And so we're putting together for 2020 a whole tour in Ohio, which will definitely include Cleveland. So, yeah, look for that next year. We're definitely planning to be there.
So the last thing I want to talk about before I let you go is what you see on a broader scale for the small cities, not necessarily the big cities. They're all working. New York and Los Angeles and Chicago are all working on these ideas, whether they're right or wrong. But it seems like you're working with some of the smaller cities that have found themselves in these horrible financial crunches and how they're getting out of it. What is it that's important about the smaller city that will probably spill out over into the bigger infrastructure?
Let's you and me get on the same page.
Okay.
Because is Cleveland a small city?
That's a really good question anymore. I think if you...
Because here's the thing I struggle with. My little town here, 13,500 people.
Yeah, that's small.
That's small. That's right. Really small. Right.
Cleveland is not that small.
No. Cleveland is a big city in the vernacular of like where I live.
It acts like a small city though.
It does.
Yes.
I think even when you go to New York, where I was last week, briefly, New York, there's no question, biggest, American city, not North American city, but largest United States city. Mexico City is bigger, in some ways, but New York is, when you get down to it, a collection of neighborhoods.
Yes.
Much the same way that Cleveland is, much the same way that my city is. It's on a different scale and it's at a different, scale of maturity. But it's the DNA of these places are shockingly similar when you start to look at it and the incremental evolution of them. My biggest fear for small town America, and by small town America, I'm going to say there's a gradation of cities like 50,000 and below, but then there's another gradation of like 5,000 and below. When we get down to those cities that are 5,000 and below, we have systematically applied the wrong building model to them. And we have burdened them and shouldered them with not only an enormous amount of infrastructure investment that they're never going to meet, but just the wrong economic development model, a model that emphasizes Walmarts and dollar stores and McDonald's over the local business. And in these places, it's those local businesses that pass the money around the communities, create the jobs, create the social cohesion and the cultural stability. We have decimated these places. And in a sense, they're the canary in the coal mine. A place like New York City or San Francisco or Portland or Seattle, Austin, these places are struggling too and struggling deeply and have deep, deep financial problems. But there's so much churn in the system. The systems are so big. There's so much kind of slack, if you think of it, that they can kind of cover up the acute problems and then ignore the others. You can have a homeless problem in Los Angeles and it has to get really, really, really bad before they start to, you know, have it become something that touches the average person, which now we're getting to that point, right? It's becoming that.
Right.
In small town America, you can't, like, the problems are more visceral. They're more in front of you. You can't escape them. And these places are deeply, deeply struggling now today. They just have the wrong business model imposed. My fear, and I think this is in my darkest days, I fear this, that a lot of these places are not going to survive the transition to something else. We have 854 cities in Minnesota. If we lost 200, 300, 400 of them over the next two decades, I would not be shocked.
Wow.
And I think we can write that off. You know, I mean, I know people in big cities would say, well, you know, their time has passed. They have no reason for being. They have no reason for existing. Okay. You know, we said that about many urban neighborhoods too, and it was a deeply despotic, unfair cultural thing. And I think very much like, you know, the abandonment of cities following World War II and the despair that many of these urban neighborhoods went through, this thing we've done to small towns is a self-inflicted wound. It did not have to be this way. I think that's what we're struggling with, and that's what we're going to have to find a way to reconcile. How do we go back and patch these places together? Is it even possible in some places to patch them back together? And if it's not, how do we have a way of discussing this cultural change that doesn't point blame at immigrants or point blame at, you know, newcomers or point blame at the left or the right or whoever it is we want to blame at the moment, but actually provides an opportunity for people to, as we say a lot at Strong Towns, start with nothing and end up with something. We've largely stripped that out of our development model today, and we have to find a way to put that back in.
It's so interesting you say that. We live in one of the ring suburbs of Cleveland that has seen a Walmart and a dollar store and sort of the demise of the small business person, even though they, you know, every once in a while a new restaurant will open, but it'll struggle. A new hardware store will open and it will struggle. So I totally get what you're saying. It's like that easy income with not a good result. Walmart, you know, got that huge tax break and brought it in, but, you know, at what expense? You know, what happened to the people it replaced?
Well, anytime you're talking about growth and efficiency, there's always a trade-off in stability. You can become more efficient, but you lose a little bit of your capacity to adapt. There's a trade-off there. At the end of World War II, we were freaked out that the Depression was just going to start right up again. There's, you know, nothing really different in our economy. We were demobilizing millions of troops and millions of people out of industry. And there was very strong reason to believe we would just go right back into economic depression. And so we created this model that was very efficient, that would create lots of growth, that would grow very, very quickly. What you give up in that model is the ability to adapt. You give up, in a sense, local stability. And now you run that out 70 plus years. And what you see is that we have cities that can grow very quickly, can add the dollar store, can add the McDonald's, can add the Walmart, can grow, but lacks the capacity to adapt and have become very, very fragile and, in a word, unstable. And that instability is not just when it comes to fixing the pipes, but it comes to lots of things. In the last chapter of the book, I don't know if you read this one or not, but I've gotten a lot of feedback on it. I pose all these questions I don't know the answer to. We have obesity problems in this country. We have problems with heart disease and depression and anxiety. Well, we built places that are basically not designed to soothe or address any of those things. And in many ways, does the exact opposite. How deeply dysfunctional are we because of the places we built? Our solution to depression is like, is there a drug that will deal with this?
Right.
But you know, and I know, one of the best things you can do to combat depression is to go for a nice walk. You know, get on your bike and bike a little bit. Let some of that, those, you know, hormones in your body start to affect your sense of well-being. This is a really hard thing to say to people who's struggling like deeply with obesity or deeply with depression. But it's hard not to see that while societies of the past had people who were depressive, they were outliers. They were not 30% or 40% of society. I think if we think of like a beehive as being an environment that is well tuned to bees, we understand that if we took a beehive and we said, all right, you bees, you know, are not getting along. We need to increase honey production. What we're going to do is we're going to create a bee cul-de-sac over here and a bee frontage road over here. And, you know, a bee interstate with interchanges. And we're just going to like make this really efficient, that ultimately you would wind up with neurotic bees. You'd wind up with bees that like failed to do what bees are supposed to do. We've created this neurotic habitat for ourselves. We've thrown away thousands of years of spooky wisdom on how to build places refined to us. And now we step back and we go, my gosh, we're suffering from all these ailments. I mean, financial is one, and we deal with that a lot at Strong Towns, but we're dealing with all these like deep cultural things that we don't seem to have good answers for. Sure, we can layer on a big experiment in social media and see what happens. Or maybe we got to step back and say, maybe there's some things here that we've thrown away in terms of how we interact with each other, how we live, how we solve problems together, that we can start to layer in again. And maybe that will help us become, you know, better humans.
So Strong Towns really is about the people who live in them.
If they're not, why bother?
What's the point? Right? You're absolutely right. Wow, this has just been, as always, a fascinating conversation. Once again, we've been talking with Chuck Marone. His new book, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity, comes out of the Strong Towns organization that he has founded and has run and has grown and has made some amazing strides in some places that you would never understand how they would have changed without him. I mean, you've actually changed people's lives. I really, it's always good to talk with you. For how can people get a copy of the book, Chuck?
You can go to strongtowns.org, and we've got the links on there to all the places. We do like to tell people you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble if you want, but you can also go to your local bookstore, and they absolutely can get it. We insisted that we work with a publisher who could make that happen, and that's really like the best way to get it for many, many reasons.
I agree. Well, Chuck, thank you so much. Take care of that cough. Thank you for talking with me. It's always a pleasure. And I hope you get some rest for the holiday season before you get back on the road.
Thank you so much. It's always wonderful to chat with you. You're such a upbeat, positive person, and I love our conversation. So let's do this again.
We will. Thank you so much. Have a great holiday.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
You too.
Chuck Marone joined me from his home in Minnesota, apparently a rare occurrence these days since he's not home much, but I always enjoy speaking with him. I learn a lot, and he gives me so much more to think about each time we talk. If you are interested in a copy of his new book, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity, log on to strongtowns.org and order it up. It might just make a really great holiday gift. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with biologist and evolutionary theorist Brett Weinstein. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. As I stated in my opening earlier, I turned to Brett Weinstein for his thoughts and insights into the issue of transgender athletes competing alongside those who compete as the gender with which he or she was born. But what I also learned is that Brett has a connection to cycling that runs very close to many of the shows we've aired over the past 9 years. Go figure. Hi, Brett. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. I wanted to talk with you about what is a very contentious issue in my world, the world of cycling, because I know you think about these things. You think about them deeply and thoroughly. We'll get to it. But what I didn't know about you, And let me just back up a second and give you a little anecdote from my yoga class last night. Two of my students are mathematics professors. And I said to one of them, the husband, I said, so do you know who Brett Weinstein is? He goes, yeah, isn't his brother Eric Weinstein? And he knows you and yeah. He knows of you and your brother. So I thought, well, that was pretty interesting. Well, he just is like over the moon that I'm going to talk to you today. So he's going to listen in. Anyway, I want to know about your connection to cycling. All of a sudden, I find out you're like heavily into cycling.
Yeah, I'm a lifelong cyclist. I've been fascinated by bikes since I was a kid, and I love riding them. I'm not a super high mileage cyclist. I've probably, in my best year, I did 6,000 miles, but most years aren't anything like that. But I just really enjoy riding, and almost as a separate matter, I really love bicycles. I like strange bicycles. I like working on them and thinking about how they might be tweaked and improved and what the future might bring. So that's more or less my story.
Well, except that there's a little addendum to that, and that is that you actually went to UBI and built a frame, right?
I absolutely did, yes. My wife, for my 40th birthday, bought me a two-week bike building course in Ashland, Oregon at UBI. And I went there, and I lived in Ashland. I rode every day in the glorious summer weather. And I built myself a frame, which I am now riding as my primary bicycle.
How cool is that?
It's really cool. I can't quite explain how delightful it is to hop on a bike that you have sweated over for weeks and thought through every detail, and then to feel it moving through the world is it's hard to explain just how wonderful that is.
So, is it a steel frame or a tie frame?
It's chromoly steel.
Okay.
And it's a 650B wheel size bike built on a modified old design. So it's basically a somewhere between a Rando and a Porter design with a reduced trail to improve loads carried on the front. And I have it rigged up with some mustache handlebars and proper racks and fenders, and I just love the thing.
Okay, so you just described the kind of bikes my husband builds. Exactly, to a T. In fact,
really?
Our tandem was built by Bushnell out at R&E in Seattle, based on my husband's design, which is, you know, a low trail, front end, handlebar bag, but whatever. But that's just so weird hearing you say that, because it's just not what I expected to come out of your mouth. But that's very, very cool. And 6,000 miles a year is nothing to sneeze at, by the way.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty good year, I have to say. I felt great. I should add one thing about my bike, which is that I modified the design so it would have an eccentric bottom bracket so that I could use a roll-off speed hub.
Yes!
Which I was a little nervous about doing, but they're so wonderful. And I'm very happy I did that.
So roll-off, which we do roll-off also, there's a drop bar adapter that is made for roll-off that goes into the end of a drop bar. That is designed.
Yeah, that's what I've had to use also.
That's my husband's design, the hubbub drop bar adapter. That's his.
Oh, my goodness. Is it really?
It is.
That's remarkable.
Well,
small world, I guess.
No kidding. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brett Weinstein, and now that we've like reminisced over all this cool stuff about cycling, which, by the way, nerding out on cycling is like my life, so I love it. But I want to talk about this other issue because it is so contentious, and there are so many facets to it, and there's a lot of upset and a lot of anger. First, explain to my listeners who you are and what you do. You are a biologist and an evolutionary theorist. What is that exactly? And then we can talk about our pressing issue.
Well, as an evolutionary theorist, I look at creatures, and I look at the patterns, sometimes between many creatures, sometimes within one creature, especially human beings. And I try to figure out why things are the way they are. So when I'm at work, I will typically look at a pattern, generate a hypothesis for what might explain it, generate predictions from that hypothesis that would allow it to be tested, and then go and check and see whether those predictions are met. That can be anything from why creatures behave in the ways that they do, why their structures are as they are, why they grow feeble with age, for example, why they divide into more species in some locations and into fewer species elsewhere, that sort of thing.
Interesting. I've been listening to some of the lectures online from your site, and I've just read something about your sort of theory about what's going to happen to the human race, which looks like it's circling the drain at some points, but we'll put that off for a different time. I want to talk about this issue with transgender athletes. So I've been holding on to a lot of data, a lot of people who have wanted to be on the show to talk about the issue. And I finally came to you looking for a very rational and very sort of objective point of view, rather than all of the vitriol that seems to be out there. Rachel McKinnon won the Women's World Track Cycling title this year. She crushed it with a new world record. She's a transgender woman. She was born a man, and she is adamant that she has every right to compete with other elite women athletes who have worked their asses off to get where they are. So you have a position on that, and you have an idea about it. Tell me what you think.
Sure. Well, the first thing to say is I'm very supportive of the rights of trans people. I know many trans folks. I taught quite a number of them when I was a professor at Evergreen, and I am supportive of their right to live as they choose. That said, there are certain places where the issues surrounding whether or not we treat someone as male or female do not come down to a simple matter of honoring people's wishes. And one of them is sport. You can find other ones with respect to things like medical treatment. And there's a particularly important question about how we treat people when they've been convicted of a crime. Do we send a person to a women's prison just because they say they're a woman? Do we do that even if they were convicted of a sex crime against some other woman? We can't. So at the point that we get to these very difficult issues, we have to turn up our skepticism and not simply abide by people's wishes, because it isn't a question of one person's rights. It's a question of competing rights. And in my opinion, the rights of trans people, trans women in particular, that is to say, people who were born male and transitioned to female, their right to compete in women's sport does not trump the right of women to compete in sport against each other without the interference of men. So we have to balance those two rights. And in this case, I think it's just very clear that the very nature of male and female creates advantages for people who are born male in most sporting activities. And the transition later in life to female does not erase those advantages. So in effect, it's cheating.
Aha, which brings me to a question about doping. So would you say that it's sort of hormonal doping? Is that a way to look at it that maybe would be less offensive to some of these transgender athletes? That it's just another way to either gain an advantage or not?
You could look at it that way, but I think that actually is going to lead us down a rabbit hole that doesn't really solve the problem. And the reason is that although the hormones have effects that are certainly of a type that will create advantages for people born male, hormonal effects are not the only effects in question. And it is also true that even for those effects that are hormonal, removing them at some point in the middle of life does not erase the advantages. So there's a whole list of changes that happen physiologically as a result of the presence of hormones earlier in life, things like bone density changes, reaction times, all sorts of things are altered by the presence of these compounds that are then not reversed if you reduce the levels. And that's before we get to the question of things that aren't mediated through hormones at all.
Such as?
Well, there are a number of effects, including some neurological effects that have been demonstrated in mice, for example, that are completely insensitive to the removal of the hormone-producing tissue. So that is to say, if we look at mice, it turns out that mice with male chromosomes, that is to say an XY mouse, is different than an XX mouse, even if we delete the hormone-producing tissues entirely from the point of being a zygote. Hmm. So not all of these differences are hormonal to begin with.
Aha. So are the Olympic committees, IOC, U.S. Olympic Committee, getting it wrong by allowing these transgender athletes to compete? Now, I could understand a woman who transitions to a man, tries to compete as a man, and it would be probably less fair to her or him than the other way around. This seems to only be an issue when a man transitions to a woman. That's where the problem seems to come in. So are the Olympic committees getting it wrong by saying it's just a matter of testing for testosterone or estrogen?
Well, first of all, I don't want to rule out the possibility that there will be a parallel issue in some case where somebody who is born female transitions to male and has some advantage. And I'm no expert in gymnastics, but it does seem to me that there are certain things that a female gymnast can do that a male gymnast can't do as a result of being smaller and more agile. Maybe that's not correct. But anyway, let's leave open the possibility that this could go both directions. I think, you know, there's sort of two levels of the question. Is the IOC wrong? Yeah, it's dead wrong. This is just a very simple question speaking at the level of biology, which isn't to say that there aren't nuances that are complex, but the basic issue, does somebody become female simply because they either say they've become female or they have gone through some sort of medical intervention? No, they certainly don't become female by doing that. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't treat them as female in informal social interactions, but in sport, especially sport at the elite level where there's a great deal at stake, it's entirely unfair. But I also think there's something to be understood. At the point I was preparing to come on the podcast, I looked into what the current state of these regulations is, and I understand that in at least some cases, the question has been tabled in advance of the upcoming Olympics, and it's been tabled for the moment because it's too contentious to settle. Now, what that suggests is something I think many of us, including you, have seen online, which is that the firepower that comes at you if you say anything other than a complete embrace of what is understood to be the trans rights perspective, anything short of that is weaponized against the person. They're called transphobe or a number of other epithets. So what that means is that the IOC is feeling the heat. It's feeling a threat about what would happen if it were to make a rational decision about the rights of trans people versus the rights of women to compete with other women. So there's a clue in there, which is we can't very well have a discussion about an empirical question. Does somebody become female at the point that they say they become female or have a medical intervention? That's an empirical question. We can't have that empirical discussion, though, with the sword of Damocles hanging over us. There can't be a threat to those who conclude one way or the other. We have to be free to explore the question and to reach a rational conclusion. And clearly, the IOC doesn't feel that it is free to reach that conclusion, which is why it's put the question off. So what I would say to all of us is that it is in no way dismissive of the rights of people to live as they prefer to require us to settle this question fairly to all parties, including women who are competing in elite competition. Now, I think this point was made very clearly by the musician Zuby, who is a man, decided to become a woman, I think, for a day in order to win a weightlifting competition where he set a record for women. And, you know, he wasn't doing this. He wasn't mocking anyone. But his point was, look, this is cheating. I'm going to show you how it can be done. And once you've seen how easily I can crush this record that no one born a woman is going to have an easy time beating, you'll understand the score. So I would look to that example. I think he did it in an honorable way and that it makes the correct point. And what we see with Rachel McKinnon, for example, is exactly the opposite, where she is competing unfairly and winning. And then the thing that protects those quote unquote wins is a threat to interfere with the reputation of anybody who says it wasn't fair.
That explains it extremely well. I'm talking with Brett Weinstein. He is an evolutionary theorist. I thought that was an outstanding explanation, and I do agree. So what do you think about the idea of a separate category?
I don't have any problem with a separate category. By the way, I should say it is Brett Weinstein.
It is Brett Weinstein. Okay.
It is Brett Weinstein. That's the correct pronunciation for the name, and then a lot of people have anglicized it. A separate category for trans people, is that the question?
Yeah.
I see no reason to object to that. My guess is that many people who are seeking the right to compete as women, though they were born male, will not be satisfied by that solution, but I don't see any reason to object to it.
Well, that leads me to the last point that I want to make, at least in this conversation, and that is the entire concept of fairness. So I've been called white privileged or whatever, that I don't understand what these young people are going through, as if I didn't live through the 60s, by the way, which I did. And that we've got an idea of fairness that leads to sameness that essentially defeats diversity in the long run, it seems. I mean, is that an illogical path?
No. And in fact, I think this is the tragedy of the moment, is that we've got a few bad actors who are steering the conversation. But most of the people who I think are on the wrong side of these issues are actually well-intentioned. They just don't understand how complex these questions actually are. And so I have no doubt that there is something that we could give the name white privilege. But when you start asserting that absolutely everybody, you know, that you can tell at 30 paces whether or not somebody is walking around with white privilege, you can't. I mean, there are all kinds of different histories. And the very fact of, you know, in my own case, I'm Jewish.
Me too.
And I think you'd have to call me, and I presume you, white. And I think, you know, it makes sense to do so. But if you want to argue that that means that we are benefiting from thousands of years of accumulated privilege while ignoring the fact that Jews were enslaved and murdered by the millions in the heart of Europe in the middle of the last century, you know, it's not a card I wish to play, but I do wish to point out that the story is not simple. You can't read on somebody's skin what their history of privilege is and write simple rules based on it. Life is simply much more complicated than that.
All right. On that note, I know you are busy. I would love to reserve the right to talk with you again. This issue isn't going away. I'm hoping it comes to some sort of solution before next summer. I guess if you say they've tabled it, that means they're allowing transgender athletes to compete. Yes? Is that what the IOC said?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know. I sort of got the impression that they had to make a ruling, but you're right. We're closing in on it. So it seems like maybe they've tabled it and left it in place.
I really appreciate that you were willing to jump in on this. Your name came up for me because I thought, who would be more objective? So I thought, well, you're pretty neutral from that perspective. You have a good view, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Have a great day, and we'll talk again.
You as well.
Okay.
Bye, Diane.
Bye. Brett Weinstein is a professor of biology and an evolutionary theorist. I know this topic, and probably this show, are going to create some controversy. However, after speaking with doctors, researchers, attorneys, and athletes, I cannot help but agree with Brett that living as a transgender person, with which I have absolutely no issue whatsoever, is very different from elite competition. The question still remains, though, and I do not think the solution is a definitive one. So that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Chuck Marone and Brett Weinstein for their outstanding conversations. There's so much to think about from both of them. Next week, I talk with Bike Law's National Director, Rachel Maney, about the organization, her path to the work she's doing, and what you can do to help keep yourself safer on the road. I also catch up with Eben Weiss, Mr. Bike Snob NYC. These days, the original anonymous blogger is high profile with his columns for Outside Online, a radio show on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and much more. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving holiday. And if you eat everything on that plate, for sure, you should get out and go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.